Okay. Let's just get started. Last year at this time, when I was about to take anatomy and also during anatomy, a lot of questions came up. Like, it came across a lot of Shilas, and I didn't really know what to do about them. I spoke to a lot of my friends about it. I spoke to Rabbanim about it. I didn't really get a clear, concrete answer to the questions, and I felt a little bit unsatisfied with what I found. So after that happened, I wanted to look more into it. So this past summer, I spent time researching these issues that I was confronted with, and that's what's forming the basis of this year right now. Before I forget, I just have to send one thank you, and he might be a little embarrassed, but it's to Jerry Karp. I happen to have pretty much read every single point of his speech over to Jerry over the course of the summer, and he helped me fine-tune various parts of it, and to many other people here who I worked on it with. So let's just get started. The first question, I'm going to try to go through six questions that I had. And the first question, they're numbered, as you can see on the Makoros. The first one that we'll address is, how should one behave in the lab? And the question that specifically is it permissible to joke around in the lab? Can you joke around? Is that a problem? So to answer this question, we're going to first define two terms that everybody needs to know, and we'll use those going forward. One term is kavod hames. So kavod hames has a technical connotation. Kavod hames, in our context, will be referring to anything which is showing disrespect to the mace, but not directly touching the mace. So, for example, joking around. So joking around would be a function of kavod hames. Then we'll talk about things that are a function of nivel hames. So nivel hames literally means like desecration of a cadaver. So nivel hames would be physically damaging a cadaver. So that would be a problem of nivel hames. So let's ask the question, how does kavod hames play out in anatomy lab? So this all begins with the first makor on the sheet. The Shulchan Aruch writes in Yeradeh Sin and Shin Samechef that in a Beis HaKfaros, ain't no again behind Kalas Rosh. That in a cemetery, we're not supposed to engage in Kalas Rosh. We're not supposed to be joking around. So the Shach there on the Shulchan Aruch writes that joking around is a problem. It's a function of Kavod Hameh. So he says that explicitly, and this is based on the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Kaf Tes, where this is stated. So this concern, this problem of joking around in front of cadavers in a cemetery, is this limited to a cemetery, or does it apply even outside of a cemetery where there happens to be cadavers, like in an anatomy lab? So I saw in the Gesher Achayim, I'm going to quote him a few times tonight. So the Gesher Achayim is Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tkachinsky. He's a well-respected acharon, and his opinions are somewhat authoritative. And Rabbi Tkachinsky writes that there is also a problem of joking around in front of cadavers outside of a cemetery. And he says like a sort of a kal vachomer. He says that in the cemetery where the cadavers are covered over and they're hidden from view and you can't see them, if there's a problem of joking around, then certainly when cadavers are in front of you and you can see them, then there's definitely a problem of joking around in front of them. So it seems to be an open and shut case. It seems to be like joking around in the lab should be something that we should refrain from. But we'll see that it's not so clear, and the reason why it might not be so clear is we have to figure out what type of cadavers do we have in an anatomy lab. So we should set this out at front, that we assume the halacha, it seems, that the cadavers in an anatomy lab are of non-Jewish origin. And it makes things a lot simpler, lehalacha, and without any evidence to the contrary, we could assume, based on the majority, that these are non-Jewish cadavers. So is there a difference of kavod hames between Jewish cadavers and non-Jewish cadavers? Now, when you first ask this question, it sounds a little bit unnerving. Like, why should there be a difference between kavodamis with between Jews and non-Jews? Like, isn't everyone, even aren't all people created with tzelem Elohim, right? And proof for this is the fact that who's described as being created with tzelem Elohim? It's Adam HaRishon. B'tzelem Elohim bara oto. So all people, it's a universal thing that people are created with tzelem Elohim. So why should there be a distinction? So some Achronim explain that the distinction may lie in the fact that Jews in their lifetime are consecrated with certain mitzvot. So, for instance, kashrus is one example. Perhaps circumcision is another example. And these mitzvot may elevate the status of the body, of the physical body. And through this, it's possible that a Jewish physical body has something that requires more of a din of kavod than non-Jewish bodies. So what we want to know is there a chiyuv of kavod hamis to non-Jewish cadavers? At least when I was looking to find the answer to this question, I didn't find any sources directly ask or answer this. There was no one who said there is a din of kavod hamis. There's no din of kavod hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. So we'll have to be a little creative to figure out if this should be the case. So there happens to be, by nivul hamis, when it comes to desecrating cadavers, there is a lot of literature on that, and the post can do discuss this, about whether or not nivul hamis does apply to non-Jewish cadavers. So the issur of nivul hamis, it comes up in Parshas Kisetze, in discussion of a criminal who is hung after they are killed. The criminal is hung, and it says, lo sal nivlaso al ha'is, that the Torah tells us that the cadaver should not be left on the gallows overnight. So from there, the Chazal tell us that this is an issur of this is a problem of nivul hamis. It's a desecration to the body, and it applies not only to criminals; it applies to everyone and any place. So we know that it's on the books that this issur exists. So does it apply to non-Jewish cadavers? So this happens to be a machlokas achronim. According to the Chasam Sofer in his tshuva in Yoredei Simin Shin Lamed Vav, as well as Rav Kook in Das Kohen Sim and Sadi Test, they both write that there is no problem of nivul hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. Now, it's important to note that they're not saying that you should just go and desecrate cadavers. No one's saying that purposeless desecration is permitted, but their context they're dealing with is an autopsy, and Rav Cook's actually discussing about medical school in particular. So in those situations where this serves a function, you can engage in nivul hamis. But in general, it's not something that we would do unnecessarily. But nevertheless, that's what the Chasam Sofer and Rav Kook say. There is an opinion, however, that there is a din of nivul hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. Rav Ben Sion Uziel, Rav Uziel was the Sephardic chief rabbi in 1948 of Israel, and he says explicitly in the tshuva that there is a din of nivul hamis for non-Jewish cadavers. And I saw also in Rabbi Bleich's volume 2 of Contemporary Halacha, Contemporary Halachic Problems, he quoted someone who quoted the Rav Soloveitchik to say that there is a problem of nivul hamis also for non-Jewish cadavers. So we have these two extremes, and there's actually a middle position as well. Rav Meir Shapiro, who is the founder of the Daf Yomi movement, so he has a tshuva, and his tshuvas are called Or HaMeir. In Siman Ayin Dalet, he writes that he thinks this is dependent on a machlokas between Rashi and Ramban al HaTorah regarding these psukim in Parshas Kisetze, where he thinks that Rashi seems to say that there is no nivul hamis for non-Jewish cadavers, but the Ramban seems to say that there is a problem of nivul hamis by non-Jewish cadavers. So this is a machlokas achronim, and it's hard to be machria who is right. So can we learn from here to kavod hamis? So they're all discussing nivul hamis. So the logic would go as follows: that if you allow nivul hamis, which is a very extreme and direct assault of the body, then kavod hamis, which is less extreme, would also be a lack of kavod hamis would also be permitted. So that would be the logic. And if that's true, if that's the case, if that logic holds, then the Chasam Sofer and Rav Kook would both say that there technically is no din of kavod hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. Others, though, who say that there is a din of nivul hamis by non-Jewish cadavers, so they may also say that there is a chiyuv of kavod hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. So it seems that we could bring a proof that there is a din of kavod hamis actually from the Beis Yosef. So the Beis Yosef, that's the next source on the Marmakomos, the Beis Yosef quotes the Kolbo, and the Kolbo writes that that v'afilu meis goy chayav levoso arba amos. He says that even for a non-Jewish cadaver, one is required to escort them a distance of 4 amos. Now, escorting the dead is a function of kavod hamis. There's a Gemara in Baba Basra daf kuf which says so explicitly, and it seems this seems to be like a bomb proof that, that there is a din of kavod hamis when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. So is this lahalacha? The Shulchan Aruch himself actually doesn't quote this lahalacha, and in the Beis Yosef he explains that this is not referring to all non-Jewish cadavers, it's only referring to righteous Gentiles. However, the Bach seems to disagree. The Bach writes that he thinks this is lahalacha. And actually, when I spoke to a few people about this question, a lot of people, Rebbeim, told me that there's a story of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. So I looked at, did a little bit of research. I found it in a book and by Rav Yonatan Rosenblum, wrote a biography about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And I actually called his son, Rav Shmuel, in Philadelphia to confirm the story. And this is what the story goes, is that Rav Yaakov was having a conversation with somebody, and a non-Jewish funeral procession came by, and Rav Yaakov stopped the conversation. He escorted the procession, and then he came back to the conversation. So it seems that maybe you can learn from this story that Rav Yaakov felt this is halacha. He felt that this is true, that there is like a din of kavod hameis even for non-Jewish cadavers. So, but again, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote a halacha, but there is the Bach. So the Bach explains that this is the halacha. So he quotes the next source on the Mar Makomos, and that's a Gemara in Gittin. So the Gemara in Gittin is describing things which we do because of Darchei Shalom. Darchei Shalom is a technical term which refers to actions that we do, between Jews and Gentiles, in order to foster good relations between us. So the Gemara explains that there are three things that we do because of Darchei Shalom. We give charity to the non-Jewish poor, we visit their sick, and we bury their dead. And we do all these things because of Darchei Shalom. So says the Bach that the things on this list are not all inclusive. It's not only these things which are required because of Darchei Shalom, but anything that's related that we do also because of Darchei Shalom. And he says so one thing that's related is escorting the dead. So it's like what's the difference between burying the dead and escorting the dead? It's a very similar thing. So that is required, and it's required because of Darchei Shalom. So let's put this all together. We want to know if there's a din of kavod hameis for non-Jewish cadavers. We try to bring proof from the fact of from nivul hameis. So we want to say that if there is no nivul hameis, then there should be no requirement of kavod hameis. But there's still room to say that even if you don't hold of nivul hameis, you could still require kavod hameis because of Darchei Shalom. We could still hold like the Chasam Sofer that there is a problem of nivul hameis. There is no problem of nivul hameis, but hold like this kolbo that there is a chiyuv of kavod hameis. So just to kind of break down the actions in anatomy lab, nivul hameis, again, there's no reason in the lab to be engaging in purposeless desecration of the body. To physically damage the body for no reason, there's no posek who recommends it as a good activity. In terms of joking around, it's a very intense environment in the lab, especially in the beginning. People aren't really used to like working with cadavers, and a lot of people like I think would say that joking around is sort of a healthy therapeutic way to deal with this like awkward environment. So is joking around really a problem? It's not so clear. Maybe it really technically is a problem, but it might not be. I don't know how to postulate on this question, but I think in general, to try to do the best we can and try to show as much COVID as possible is always a recommended activity. Okay, that's the first question. So let's move on to the second question. And the second question is, can you bring a visitor to the lab? Now, here at Einstein, all of the people who are in lab are offered the option to bring a visitor. So, like, people want to bring a visitor to come and see on off hours what the lab is like. So are there any problems with that? So, we're gonna approach this question in that in terms of hana'a min hames, that there is an iser of hana'a min hames, of getting benefit from a cadaver, and we'll have to see, would it be possible that a visitor coming to the lab would be in violation of this principle? So what's this hana'a min hames? So that next makora on the Mar Makomos is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the Andaf Kaf Tes. So the Gemara there, it's a little bit technical, so I'll just say it outside. It learns through Gzeira Sheva, one of the principles in learning, that there is an iser of hana'a from a cadaver, that you're not allowed to gain benefit from a cadaver. You can see there if you want to see why. So this is brought down the halacha, and seems to be a machlokis whether or not this applies to Jews or also applies to non-Jewish cadavers. And again, we could explain the same way we've explained nivlamates why there would be differences between the two. Happens to be that most Rishonim assume there is no iser hana'a min hames regarding non-Jewish cadavers. But if you take a look at the next source, the Shulchan Aruch, he writes that there is a problem of a namina mace when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. So he happens to be talking about the burial shroud, the tachrichim. He says the tachrichim are asurim behana, which it's clear that he means also that the cadavers themselves are also asur behana. So a lot of the achronim are a little bit upset about this Shulchan Aruch because it doesn't seem to be the mainstream opinion in the Rishonim. The Gra quotes many to argue against this, the Shulchan Aruch. The Shach also in the Kudas HaKesef, he quotes many opinions which say that there is no Isser Hanah for non-Jewish Mason. And Chasam Sofer, in that same Tshuva, in Simin Shem Amavav of Yardea, he also writes that there is no Isser Hanah when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers. But we don't like to go against the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says it, and the Ramah is silent. He doesn't argue, so it seems like he is modeh, that he agrees. And the Levush also, he also writes that there is an Isser Hanah. So is this an Isser D'Oraita or an Isser D'Rabbanan? Most assume that for Jewish cadavers, it's an Isser D'Oraita. And you would think also for non-Jews it would be the same, that it would also be an Isser D'Oraita. But the Pisei Tshuva there on the Shulchan Aruch, he actually quotes an opinion that for non-Jews it's only an Isser D'Rabbanan. So those are the different shitas. There's an opinion of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I found this in the Hebrew version of the Nishmas Avraham, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that this distinction between Jews and non-Jews in terms of this Isser Hanah explains why we're allowed to do anatomy in the first place. So he says that when it comes to non-Jewish cadavers, true, the Shulchan Aruch says that there is an Isser Hanah, but that's only when there's no purpose. But if it has a purpose, and he says explicitly, like to learn medicine, so in that case, there it's permissible to engage in Hanah mimeis akum from non-Jewish cadavers. So it seems like we're all relying on this opinion of Rav Shlomo Zalman. That's why all of us are permitted to engage in an anatomy in the first place. But maybe we could argue that this would only work for people who are in anatomy, who are doing the dissection themselves. Because maybe we would say that for the people who are doing the dissection, that's a lofty purpose. That holy endeavor of being able to treat people and save people in the future, for that we permit hana min hames. And that's when we will allow it. But maybe you wouldn't say that for a lab visitor. You know, a lab visitor, you know, it could be a valuable experience, but maybe we would say that in that case, it's not something that would warrant hanam and hames. So that wouldn't allow us to assume, like those opinions, to say that there is no hanam and hames from non-Jewish cadavers. So if there is a problem of hanam and hames for the lab visitor, our next task is to figure out how do you get hana. This is a technical term of getting hana. So how do you define that, and how does that play out in the lab? So we're going to examine two separate ways in which you could potentially be getting hana. One way would be through learning information. So it could be that a visitor could like learn from the cadaver like how the body works, or potentially there is a value in learning that could go on. So that's one thing that we'll examine. And the next thing that we'll examine is in terms of looking at the body and being amazed at it and saying, wow, this is incredible. Hashem's creation is so beautiful. So maybe that sort of, if that experience happens, then maybe that's also a type of hana that we have to be concerned about. So let's start with the first one, learning. Does learning information constitute hana? So this comes up in many different shuvas, and one of the more well-known ones is from the Noda Yehuda and Simon Reish Yod of Yoredea. The Noda Yehuda is discussing doing an autopsy on a Jewish cadaver in order to help people in the future to learn about a specific disease. So the Noda Yehuda, in the course of that shuva, he never once mentions the Isser of Hanam and Hames. He just doesn't say it. So some assume from this shuva Noda Yehuda that he doesn't hold that there's an isser that learning information for the future. It seems like he doesn't hold that's considered hana. The Hart Zvi, Rav Zvi Pesach Frank in a tshuva, he writes like that. He thinks that there is no isser hana in just learning information, and he thinks that's the opinion of that's what the Noda Yehuda holds as well. The Chasam Sofar, however, in that same tshuva we've been quoting, he mentions this case of the Noda Yehuda, and the Chasam Sofar says that there explicitly he says that there is a problem of hana in that case, that learning itself is a type of hana. So this is a machlokas achronim. I'm not sure exactly how to pass on this one, but it's something definitely to keep in mind that learning could be a problem.
Right.
So I mean, I guess, but if he's discussing a Jew, then and he doesn't mention the Isra of Hana, then for sure, for not for.
Right. But I'm saying with Sam Sofer, I'm saying who says that there might be. Meaning he's the only one.
Oh yeah. So that's right. So I didn't say. Maybe I didn't say so clearly. But Sam Sofer holds that there is no Isra of Hana for non-Jews, but he says that for Jews it would have been a problem of learning,
mm-hmm.
So in that case you shouldn't do autopsy, but for non-Jews it wouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
so there's no one who really says that there's
been a trauma. In learning you're saying?
In learning.
So that well, right. Yeah, I'm not sure. Let's talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I hear you saying. Let's talk about it. Okay, good point. Okay. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind is this concern of learning information. The next one is looking at something and seeing its beauty. So is that a problem? So that's the next makor on the Mar Makomos, where the Gemara in Pesachim it quotes that kol umara v'reach ein bahen mishum me'ila. Introduced that me'ila is an isser hana which is associated with the Beis Hamikdash. So the Gemara explains that. We'll take out for our interest that Mara, that the site of the Beis Hamikdash or things inside the Beis Hamikdash, don't have a concern of Me'ila, meaning that there is no Isser Hana associated with that action. So Rashi explains in a different Gemara, but it's a parallel sugya in Krisus. Rashi explains that what is Mara in this case? He says it's Hanana ni Mara Yafa Shel Heichal. That to benefit from the beautiful appearance of the Heichal, that's Hana. So that's kind of, that's what we're dealing with here. So the Gemara says that there is no Me'ila, but it continues that Me'ula hu deleka ha isura ika, that there is no Me'ila, but it's still Usher. So the simple understanding of this Gemara is that there is no Me'ila midaraisa, but midarabanan it would be a problem. There are some who say that it could even mean midaraisa is a problem. But that's what it says. So this seems to show that there is a problem when it comes to seeing something and like your own just looking at something, gazing at something could constitute hana. So does this apply only to Me'ila, only in the Beis Hamikdash, or does it apply to other areas of halacha as well? So Rav Avadi Yosef in Yabia Omer, in Chelek Vav, in one of his tshuvas, he writes that, and he quotes in his classic style, he quotes many different sources to prove that this doesn't only apply to Me'ilah, it applies to all Yisurei Hana'ah, that just looking at something could be a concern of Hana'ah. And he quotes a din in Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch, in terms of Avodah Zarah, the Shulchan Aruch says that you shouldn't like gaze at Avodah Zarah and be wowed by its beauty. That would be a problem. So that's one of his sources. He has many other sources as well, and that's what he says. So just putting this all together. We're not so sure that there should be a problem of hana to begin with for the lab visitor, but even if there is a concern, it most likely whether or not he or she is engaging in hana minames would depend on the experience that they have. So if someone in general would just be coming and looking around and not really gaining so much by learning information or not really like wowing at the beauty of it, so that's probably not a concern. I spoke to Rav Schechter about this question, and Rav Schechter, that's what he told me. He said that for someone just, he said if someone wants to bring their spouse, and the spouse wants to know, like, what have they been up to for the past, like, few months? So he thought in that scenario that it probably would not be a concern. That's what Rav Schechter told me. If theoretically, if somebody really were to, like, be wowed by the cadaver, they're really going to like absorb a lot of information, there is a concern. Okay, that's the second question. So let's move on to the third one. The third one is going to regard the bone boxes. Have they given you bone boxes yet? Okay. So every person and their lab partner gets one bone box. And the bone box is what it sounds like. It's a box of bones. And from this box of bones, you learn osteology. That's how you study the bones. So you'll see that it's sort of like 50-50, I think. Do people like keep them in their lockers or like bring them home? I think some people bring them home, some people only keep them in their lockers. So what the question that we want to ask is, do the bone boxes pose any concerns of tuma? Like, should a Kohen be concerned that maybe this is like giving off tuma? For instance, if somebody has a friend and they want to invite over for Shabbos, and it's during anatomy time, so should they be concerned that there's like bone boxes in people's apartments, and that would cause tuma for a visiting kohen? That's one question. And then the corollary question is: should the student be concerned, like, you know, maybe I shouldn't bring this around places that I might find kohanim? Like, should that be a concern for the student? And I just want to say up front, this discussion will have no bearing on students themselves who are Kohanim. They have potentially other post-game or other rules to be relying on. But I'm just talking about a regular case, a regular Kohen who wants to visit for Shabbos. That's what we would like to discuss. So questions that revolve around Tumas Kohanim, the Zmanazeh, this day and age, they always start off by asking, is there really a problem of Tumah b'zman hazeh? Like, should we really be concerned about that? Because aren't Kohanim, after all, Tumah already, like, Tameh already? Like, is that a problem? So the Rambam writes explicitly that it is a problem to add Tumah. There's a problem to add Tumah already to pre-existing Tumah. But there is a Raivid. The Raivid is on this Rambam in Hilchos Nezirus. The Raivid writes, he seems to say that there isn't a problem, that just to add tuma when somebody's already tame is not really a concern. But the poskim are not willing to rely on this ravid lehalacha for the following reason. The poskim question, did the ravid mean that there's no problem whatsoever for a kohen to add a new type of tuma, or did he only mean that there's no punishment for it, but maybe it's still usher? So they're actually the Dago Miravava on Shulchan Aruch. He actually writes that maybe even the Ravid holds is an Isser Daraisa for a Kohen. So the Poskim aren't really willing to rely on this Ravid Lakula. Maybe to add it as a Smith Lahaka, when you want to add a bunch of Kulas together, maybe it would be possible. But Lichatzila, we don't accept that. So we need to discuss Tumas Ohel. Tumas Ohel, and the case that we'll describe, is when a Kohen and Tumah are in the same Ohel. So in general, that would be a simple scenario. Would be that if there's, you know, you're in the same room and there's tumah and the coin's in that room. So that would be a problem of tumas ohel. And tumas ohel is a concern for kohanim. We know that this is a concern for Jewish sources of tumah, for Jewish cadavers. But is it a problem when the sources of tumah originate from non-Jews? So this is a machlokas. It's quoted in the Beis Yosef in Simon Shinayim Beis of Yoredeya. The Beis Yosef quotes a machlokas between the Rambam and Tosfos and Bava Metzia. You see, the Rambam writes that there's no problem of tumas ohel for non-Jews. For non-Jewish cadavers. Tosas, however, says that there is a problem of tumas ohel regarding non-Jewish cadavers. And it happens to be that most of the Rishonim assume that there is no problem of tumas ohel for non-Jewish cadavers, but the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah are machmir for this opinion of Tosas. So they say, the Shulchan Aruch writes in Shinayim Beis, Sif Beis, in Yoredeya, he says that nachol mizaher, that it's proper to be careful to avoid stepping over non-Jewish graves. And the Ramah writes that even though there are opinions who are meko, he says the nachol nahachmer, that it's nachol nahachmer. So they're not saying it as a certain like serious issue, but it's there. We're stringent, but the way they phrase it is important to note. Okay, so now we know that this machlokas exists regarding non-Jewish sources of tumah. So our next task then is to figure out what collection of bones would be able to be metame be'ohel. So we know that a complete mace, an entire cadaver, is able to be metame be'ohel. But what about pieces of a cadaver, or just bones themselves, dry bones? So are those able to be metame be'ohel? So this is actually a fun question. The Mishnah in Ohalos, it's towards the beginning of Ohalos. Sorry, I don't remember which Mishnah exactly. But the Rambam basically is paraphrasing this Mishnah. And that's what there on the Makoros, Halachos Tumas Meis Peret Beis, Halachos Chesen Tes. And I'm just going to focus on the underline there, but you can have it to look at later if you'd like. There are going to be five collections of bones, dry bones, that on their own can impart tumas ohel. What are the five collections? Number one is the shedra, the spine. So that is able to be metame be'ohel. Number two is the gilgoleth, a skull can be metame be'ohel. Number three is rov binyano. So the binyan of a person, as the Rambam writes, the binyan of a person consists of two bones in the leg, from the knee to the ankle, one bone in the thigh, the spine, and the ribs. He says that's the entire binyan of a person, the entire structure of a person. So rov binyan, he says, and he's quoting Gemara's and earlier sources, that rov binyan would be, for instance, two bones of the leg and one of the thigh. So in modern terms, it would be the tibia, the fibula, and the femur. That those three on their own can impart tumas ohel. And then the fourth category that on its own can impart tumas ohel is rov minyano, the majority of the number of bones in a person. The Mishnah it's the last Mishnah of the first parak in Ohelos. It lists there's 248 avarim in the human body. So, and the commentaries explain that each aver consists of one bone. So that means there's 248 bones in the human body. And so rov minyano, the majority of the number of bones, then is 125. The Gemara says so explicitly, and that's what the Rambam says as well. So that's the fourth category. And the fifth category is found in Halacha Tes, where he writes that rova hakav is a volume measurement, that measurement of bones, that volume is able to impart tumas ohel, and in modern terms, a kav is roughly two quarts. So rova hakav, a quarter of that is about one pint, which is not so big. So those are the basic halachas. Those are the types of dry bones which can impart tumas ohel. So now let's go back to those bone boxes. Do those fulfill the requirement of the Rambam? So first you would say, of course, it fulfills the requirement because they definitely have Rova HaKav. That there's definitely, if you look at the boxes, you put it all together, it seems to be clear that I would think any bone box really, to be a useful teaching tool, would have to have at least a pint of volume worth of bones in order to be in the box. So that would mean then, according to this Rambam, that the bone boxes do indeed impart Tumas Ohel, even if the other one, maybe that they do or don't fulfill the first four requirements, but it doesn't matter, because the fifth requirement, they do have Rova HaKav. But it's not so simple that all Rishonim agree to this Rambam. There is a day in Tosos, it's found in Maseches Nazir, the Mishnah there is discussing Tuma in regards to a Nazir, because we know that a Nazir is also forbidden to become Tameh. So the Tosos there writes that Rova HaKav doesn't mean a Rova HaKav of any bones. It's not just any bones, but it's a technical thing that it has to come from Rov Minyan and Rov Binyan. It's a little complicated, but suffice it to say, our bone boxes would not satisfy Rova HaKav. That Rova HaKav is this technical thing of broken bones, and this wouldn't satisfy Rova HaKav. So for those other Rishonim, we'll have to see if those other categories, the first four that we mentioned, if they by themselves would be able to correspond to our bone boxes. So let's go through them one by one. First, the Shedra, the spine. So the Rambam writes that there are 18 vertebrae in the human body, and that's based on this Mishnah in the first parak of Ohalos. And modern anatomists count much more than that. But if you look at the Mishnah, you'll see that the cervical vertebrae are not included. It counts bones in the neck separately, and the vertebrae is counting from below the neck. But the Rambam writes that you need all 18. The Mishnah says there's 18, and the Rambam says you need all 18 to impart Tumas Ohel. And if you're missing just one, there won't be Tumas Ohel. So that's something to keep in mind, that maybe bone boxes wouldn't have all 18 of these vertebrae. We'd have to look and see. The next is the Gilgola, the skull. So the Rambam writes that a full skull is Metame Ohel, but if it's missing a sella, and a sella is a coin, which is roughly a third of a tefach, it's not very big, if it's missing that amount, it's not Metame Ohel. So a lot of bone boxes only have half of a skull. So if they only have half of a skull, then the skull itself is not Metame Ohel, because you need to have much more than that. The third category, Rov Vinyano. Some bone boxes may have the tibia, fibula, and the femur, but I'm not sure. It's something that I'm excited to look at people's bone boxes and see, do they actually have those inside or not? But some bone boxes may indeed have that. In Rov Minyano, 125 bones, I'm not so sure that bone boxes have that amount. It sounds like a lot, but it's possible. But it's something, again, it could be a fun exercise to look at these bone boxes once the anatomy starts and examine what's inside.
Does it have to be Rov Minyan from both sides? Like, for both the right and
just one side. Okay. Yeah, just one side is enough. Oh, yeah.
Do teeth count as bones?
Maybe. I don't know I think in the Mishnah, I don't think it's talked about that. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I just need the Mishnah. They're not? Okay.
Do you know if Rov Vinyano has to be the same person?
Yeah, so. Yeah, so there is a Mishnah in Ohalos which says that for some of these categories, for all of them except for, I believe it's all of them except for Rov Binyan and Rov Minyan, it has to come from one person, one cadaver. If it comes from multiple, so if you had, like, if you just had, like, one femur from a million different people, I think that probably would not be Matanya Ve'Ohel. I saw in a Kuntris Sefer about Tumas Kohanim, so they said that all of these five things, they have to come from one person. So that's something also to keep in mind. I assume that most probably each bone box comes from one person. I'm not sure though. But if they don't, no.
They would not.
You think not that? They get mixed up. Okay. So maybe not. So, but anyway, it could be that, let's say it's made up of five people. I don't know. It still could be that there is still enough from one person to impart some soul, but that's a good, that is something to keep in mind, and we should include that in our conclusion, that when we try to think of things that are potential room to be makel for this question. Okay. So that's the discussion of do they impart tumah, these collections of bones. So it's unclear. I'm not exactly sure, and I'm excited to look at people's bone boxes. Hope you don't mind if I do that, and see what we find. The next question is: does the box itself block the tumah, like inside the box? So to do that, it would have to serve as an ohel to keep the tumah inside. So there's a Mishnah also in Ohelos which says that to serve as an ohel, there in terms of the dimensions of the ohel, there it has to be tefach al tefach v'rum tefach, meaning it has to be a tefach wide and tefach long and one tefach above the source of tumah. So it could be that bone boxes do satisfy that requirement. It would depend on each individual box that maybe in terms of the dimensions, it would satisfy as an ohel to block the tumah. However, the material also has to be able to block in tumah. So there's a klal there's a rule in Hilchos Tumah that kol davar ha-mekabel tumah eino choset bifnei ha-tumah. That if something itself is mekabel tumah, it won't block tumah inside. So if you look in the Rambam in the first halacha in Hilchos Kelim, the Rambam lists what's mekabel tumah and what's not. So he says that wood and metal are mekabel tumah. So our boxes are wooden. So if they're wooden or metal, then they would not be a sufficient barrier to keep the tumah inside because they themselves are mekabel tumah. If theoretically you could have a box made of plastic, plastic is probably not mekabel tumah. There's a Barei HaShulchan. I saw he says that explicitly. It comes up in Hilchos Nida. He writes that plastic is not mekabel tumah. But I think here at Einstein, the boxes are made of wood.
Maybe people should put their wooden bone boxes inside a larger plastic.
Plastic bag. It has to be above. It has to have room tefach. Tefach atav of room tefach.
Well, if there's the room tefach in the
outside the box.
No, in the wooden box, would then the plastic box.
And plastic outside the wooden box?
Yeah.
Right. That'd be a good... Maybe we should start... I'll quote Jerry on that. Everyone should start doing...
have a vendor or something. Plastic box.
Okay. So the boxes themselves probably don't block the tumah inside. So then the next thing we want to know is, how does tumah spread throughout a building? Like, how does this exactly work? So in general, with Tumas Ohel, I'll throw out some examples. If a Kohen is in the same room as the bone box and it's Metame Ohel, then and we're concerned about Tumas Ohel for non-Jews and etc., then in the same room, there is a problem that it's once he's in the same room. Let's say a Kohen is in the hallway and you're inside your room and the door is closed. So if the door is closed, almost all the posts can assume that that will block the tumah, and tumah does not go into the hallway. But when the door is open, tumah goes into the hallway, and then the kohen contracts tumah. So if this was our only concern of doors opening and being in the same room, then maybe we could get around this issue. Maybe we could have a kohen if they're concerned about this issue. They could, make sure there's no bone boxes in the apartment they're staying at where they're eating their meals. They'll try to make sure there's no bone boxes in that apartment. Maybe they could do that and get out of this problem. But there is another halacha which may make this much more problematic. And there's a halacha in Hilchos Tumah, and that's called Sof Tumah Lattes. Sof Tumah Lattes also comes up. It's a Mishnah, I believe it's in Perek Zion of Mishnah Olos. Where the Mishnah discusses a case of sof tumah lattes, which means that wherever a corpse is, or a body or maybe the bone boxes are in a specific room, that wherever that corpse or source of tumah will be exiting, that it's ki'ilu, we view it as if there's tumah in that place right now. So, for example, if there's tuma in somebody, if somebody has a boombox in their room and it's metame ve'ohel, since they may bring it outside through the through their hallway, so it's reviewed as if the hallway has tuma in it right now. Since they may go through the elevator, it's as if the elevator has tuma in it right now. It's as if the lobby, maybe even the parking lot. It's all these cases of where it's possible that a person may take out the boombox, we would view it as if there's tuma there right now. And that's the Ramah, it's on the last makor on the page, the Ramah explains that in a case of sof tuma lateis, he says that mishum dehoel v'sof tuma lateis derech sham, roen ki ilu yata. He says that since the tuma is going to go through that way, we view it as if it's already left, that there's already tuma there. So does this apply to non-Jewish cadavers? We know that this law of sof tuma lateis applies to Jewish cadavers. Does it apply to non-Jewish cadavers as well? So I saw in the Gesher HaChaim again, the Gesher HaChaim writes that since tumas ol of non-Jewish cadavers is only midirabanan to begin with, then we're not worried about sof tuma lateis. So that's potentially a big kula. That the Gesher HaChaim says that there's no sof tuma lateis for non-Jewish cadavers. Rav Shechter also in the Ikfei Atzon, he writes about this question, and he seems to say that there is no sof tuma lateis for non-Jewish cadavers. And one of the reasons he says is that we just don't go so far to be concerned for all of these things regarding non-Jews.
So if let's say someone had a bone box in you're saying like room, but let's say someone had a bone box in a closet that had a minimum, let's say da'at tfachim, which I think is a minimum shiur for rishus. So if that's in a closet with a door, would that, I know you said in a room, so like let's say you're in the apartment, could you be in other areas of the apartment if it's in a closet, you think? Or?
So I think, I mean, in terms of sof tuma lateis?
No, it's because if we don't pass the sof tuma.
If we don't have sof tuma lateis, then yeah, if dalet al dalet, I'm not sure the exact shear of a room, but yeah, if
so
meaning
it's
like, yeah, like if it's in one room and the door is closed and like that's its own rishus,
so
then you could be in the other room.
So
if we wouldn't.
Closet would work as well.
If that, yeah, I'm not sure if that counts, but if it did, then...
Say
it again?
The door would have to be something that can't be
Mikhail. Well, doors and... There's a question of doors because, yeah, if they're Mikhail or Karka. I'm not really sure, honestly. Okay? Great. So let's just recap this question, and we'll try to do the next few questions. They're shorter questions, so you won't be here all night. So in summary, we're not so sure we should be concerned about tumas meis for non-Jews in general, but the Shulchan Aruch and Amar are machmir. So how do the bone boxes fit in? It's possible that the bone boxes may not even have the right amount of bones to be metame ba'ol according to all Rishonim. According to the Rambam, they definitely do, but according to others, maybe not. We would have to see. And still, we're not so sure that we hold a sof tuma lateis for the bone boxes. So the halacha, everyone should ask the child themselves. But these would be things to keep in mind when dealing with this question. Okay, so then we turn the page to the next question, and that's about washing the hands. We know that when we go to a cemetery and you leave the cemetery, people wash their hands. So is that applied to anatomy lab as well? Do people have to wash their hands afterwards? So we'll see. Everybody's going to wash their hands with soap and water. Don't not do that. But maybe we'll see that there is an additional washing that may be required. So this comes up in Shulchan Aruch there. It's at the first source there, where the Shulchan Aruch lists things which are required, which one is required to wash their hands for. And two of the things on the list are haholech bein hamesim, which the commentaries assume means to be in a cemetery, if you're in a cemetery, and misha nuga b'mase, that is somebody touches a mase. So that's what we're doing in anatomy lab. You're in front of mason, you're touching them. The Magen Avraham also there quotes a minhag that even if you're in front of a mase, but not at a cemetery, but you're just within dalet amos of a mase, you should also wash your hands. So it seems to be like, we definitely should be washing our hands after anatomy lab. And there seems to also be no distinction between Jews and non-Jews in this cadavers in this question. The Kaf HaChaim, he writes that if you touch a non-Jewish cadaver, you also have to wash your hands afterwards. Rav Yitzchak Yosef, who is the author of Yalkut Yosef, we have it back there, and he's the son of Rav Avadi Yosef, he writes that for in a non-Jewish cemetery also. After leaving a non-Jewish cemetery, you would also have to wash your hands. And it seems to be, you know, like not such a hard thing to do, like washing your hands. So should we be washing our hands after Ananda because of this concern? And this is an issue of Ruach Ra. So it seems like maybe, you know, we probably should be washing our hands after an anatomy lab. But everybody in an anatomy lab washes their hands on the sink. You guys already went to the lab, so you know the sinks are in the same room. So everybody's going to wash their hands with soap and water, almost everybody at least, in that sink, and then they'll leave the room. So the question we want to know is does that washing work for this issue of Metilas Yadayim of washing the hands. So the Magen Avraham, that's the next source, he writes that in all of these cases that the Shulchan Aruch above in the source above is talking about, they don't require three times. You know, in the morning we wash three times. He says these cases you don't have to wash three times. The Aruch HaShulchan quotes this Magen Avraham lehalacha. The Mishnah Berurah also quotes this Magen Avraham lehalacha, but he quotes also Yesh Omrim that maybe you should wash three times. But this definitely is a valid shita that to not wash three times in this scenario. What about a kli? We know that in the morning we use a kli. So do you have to wash from a kli? Most of the poskim don't mention it. They don't talk about it. So it seems like when they don't mention it, that you probably don't require a kli in these scenarios. But I saw quoted in the Piskei Tshuvos, and we have it back there, the Sefer, he quotes some people who say that you do require a kli in this case, but it seems to be that maybe the majority do not say that you should require a kli. And it's important to note also, the Raman, the next source, writes that Bidi Eved, in the morning, you don't even need a kli. That he says that it's eno ma'akev lo kliv lo koach gavra. That in the morning, which is the most stringent time that we have to wash our hands and say a bracha, that in that time you don't require a kli. So then, b'dieved for sure in an anatomy lab, I don't think you would require a kli. So also it's important to note the Mishnah Berurah writes that when we're dealing with ruach ra, you should really try to wash your hands right away. We don't want to have Ruach Ra lingering on our hands. And he also quotes a Ramah separately to say that you shouldn't enter into another building if you have Ruach Ra on your hands. So we should seemingly be trying to do this. So how does that work in anatomy? Does this hand washing that everybody's going to be doing in those sinks work? So maybe not. It might not work. And why not? It might not work because right after you wash, you're walking right past the cadavers again because you're still in the lab. So you may be getting like Ruach Ra again right after you just wash your hands. So it's possible that you would have to wash your hands again after leaving. But how much of a washing would you need? Maybe you don't need to wash three times, and maybe you don't even need a kli. I'm not so clear. Everybody should ask the Shaila on their own. But maybe one possibility would be, so if you're in the bathroom after lab, to just kind of run the sink over your hands again. Maybe that would be a way to satisfy these requirements. In a sensible way. Okay, the next question is tzitzit. Tzitzit, should guys be wearing tzitzit in the lab? The question is, it's kind of like a dirty place. Maybe it's a bizayon. Maybe in that scenario, one should not be wearing their tzitzit, or maybe they should be wearing their tzitzit. One may think that it's similar to like a cemetery. You know, like in a cemetery, you tuck your tzitzis in if you wear them out. So maybe, and that's the source of the Shulchan Aruch, right? that you should tuck in your tzitzis in a cemetery. But the simple understanding is that this does not apply in our lab because, again, the cadavers are non-Jewish. And we would assume in that scenario that the reason why we normally tuck them in is because of loig l'rush. Loig l'rush, it comes, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, it says loig l'rush cheref oseyu, that one who mocks a pauper is like it's like mocking Hashem. So what that means is that if you wear your tzitzis out in front of cadavers and they're not able to fulfill this mitzvah, then it's not a nice thing for them. So we should tuck in the tzitzis. So but when it's in an anatomy lab, if the cadavers are non-Jewish, that's probably not really a concern. But you also see from that Shulchan Aruch that there's no cadavers themselves are not like like, you know, dirty things, or they're not something that we should shy away from. The only concern is that of Lois Arush, which doesn't apply in anatomy lab. So what about Bizayon? Is there a Bizayon? So the Shulchan Aruch from the next source writes that you're allowed to wear tzitzis in a bathroom. So we have to remember that the Shulchan Aruch is talking in the 1500s. In the 1500s, they didn't have these nice bathrooms like the Einstein Shul is lucky to have. They had outhouses. They weren't these like nice, pretty places. And he still says that it's mutter to wear tzitzis in those places. So the argument should go that if you could wear it in that kind of bathroom, you should also be able to wear it in the lab, and you should wear it in the lab. So that's what I would have thought. And when I spoke to Rav Schechter, he told me that he thinks I was wrong. He thought that really there is a Bizayon in the lab, but it's for a different reason. He said, because you probably already noticed the smell. There's a smell in the lab which stays in your clothes. So I actually have my scrub still in my apartment. I'm sure my wife doesn't like that I still have them in the apartment. But those still smell. They actually still have the smell of lab on them. So Rav Schechter felt that's a Bizayon to tzitzis. If tzitzis still have a smell on them, it's not a nice smell, then that would be a Bizayon. So that was Rav Schechter's opinion. Everybody, again, asked the shout-out to their Rav. But that's the story. So that's in terms of the Bizayon. The next question is, what about how do you make brachas? So I maybe, because of time, we'll finish at 10. Try to finish that. Okay, so in the interest of time, some people may indeed wear tzitzis if that's what they're told and what they think is right. If someone's not going to wear tzitzis, so how do you do that? So most people will wake up in the morning and put on their tzitzis. They'll make a bracha, and then they'll go to davening. They'll have a morning breakfast, and then they'll go to lab. So when they go to lab and they take off their tzitzis, there's now going to be a hesek of wearing a tzitzis. So lab's about 2.5 hours long. So is that amount of time considered a hesek that when you put the tzitzis back on, you have to make a new bracha? So Rav Schechter told me that he felt that even like 25, 30 minutes could be enough of a time that warrants a new bracha. So in that case, in an anatomy lab, if you put the tzitzis back on, you should make a new bracha. But I saw others quote, in a sefer, Simcha Bunim Cohen, in the Laws of Daily Living. So he writes that even up to 3 hours may not be considered a hefsek. And he quotes Halicho Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach, who writes along those lines, and he quotes it from a Shulchan Aruch HaRav, that even an activity lasting up to 3 hours would not be a hefsek, and which lab, which maybe lasts 2.5 hours, wouldn't be a hefsek according to those opinions. So that seems to be a machlokas. There's a range of opinions of what's considered a hefsek, and everybody again should ask the shaila. The last question is talking divrei Torah in the lab. When I was in the lab, my lab group and the group next to me, we were all Orthodox Jews, and my chavrusa actually happened to be sitting next to me. And naturally, you know, we would review yesterday's learning in shiur. But we would ask questions. Things came up, and actually, it's funny. I think ironically that it's these exact questions which were most commonly that we would talk about in the lab. So is that appropriate? So there's a bunch of issues which we'd have to address. I'll just try to name them briefly. The first would be the smell. We know that bad smells prevent one from speaking Torah. But the Mishnah Berurah quotes the Chayyad, and that's the first source, that something which smells naturally bad. So, for instance, itron is tar. So, a substance which smells bad from the time it's created, that kind of smell does not prevent one from speaking words of Torah. So the bad smell, I don't think, is a problem in terms of speaking words of Torah in the lab. There is, however, a concern of touching dirty places. We know, like, when you're in davening, when you're speaking Torah, you're not supposed to touch dirty places, and that would be a problem. So seemingly in lab, you're touching like these parts of the body. That's the next source in Shulchan Aruch on the page there. That when you're touching these parts of the cadavers like every day almost. So like, how can you talk Torah if your hands are touching the dirty parts of the body? But people wear gloves. So do gloves help? So the Darach Moshe quotes two opinions which seem to imply that gloves would help. He talks about maybe scratching yourself like during dabbing, like over your clothes. And actually the Ramah here, he even talks about if you have like mucus in the ears or the nose, like to rub them like through an intervening material, that wouldn't be a problem. So it's possible that gloves would prevent this concern. However, I'm not so sure that's true, because like the dirt is on the gloves the entire lab session. So maybe just like, you know, wiping one time isn't a problem. But if there's a material on the glove the entire lab session, maybe that would be a problem. The next two concerns relate to SOA, which is excrement, and also relate to erva. So SOA may come up in the lab when doing the abdominal dissection. That may be a problem, and it could also be that erva is a problem. That comes from this pasuk on the bottom of the page. I won't go through it, but these are potential concerns. And if anybody wants to talk to me more about the details, which I don't have time now to go through, we could discuss more about it. But there, you know, there are issues of talking to her in the lab, and it's possible that it would be allowed in certain circumstances. But it may be wise to try to avoid it if possible, because there's a lot of times where it may be a problem, and it may always be a problem if the gloves don't help. So that's something we should keep in mind. So those are the six questions. I would love to continue to talk to people about these questions. If anybody wants to come up to me and speak more about it, I'd love to be in touch. Thank you.
Yeah.